Well, maybe we could start up at, ask if you were born in Winnipeg and...
No, I was born in Russell, Manitoba.
Russell, Manitoba.
Yeah.
My uncle was born in that area there, and my mother was from Kingston. Her name was McFarlane.
No, that's so many years ago. Too many, actually.
Well, did you come into Winnipeg and join the Grenadiers specifically? Or did you...
No, I was living in Winnipeg at the time and joined the Grenadiers.
Had the war broken
out? Yeah.
Can I ask one? Why did you join the Grenadiers at that time? Did you have any friends?
To eat.
To eat?
Yes. Same as 90% of them, only they don't admit it.
It was a job at that time.
That's right.
Something that really threw your head,
I was working for Scott Fruit, who were the main part of their wholesale business was import stuff, and they weren't getting the imports that they wanted, and I could see the handwriting on the wall where somebody was going to be looking for a job. No, I just used the paint. So I was with the field artillery at the time there, a non-permanent force. There didn't seem to be much going on there, and I figured if I was in it, I may as well get in with both feet, so I went to the Cameron Highlanders, and I went to the Winnipeg Grenadiers, and I used to alternate. The Winnipeg Grenadiers signed me up first. That's...
Did you go to Japan? About when? 1939?
Yeah, 1939.
Was the war starting in Europe at that time?
Yeah.
Well, you went to Jamaica with the rest of the men? Yeah. Well, there's something on my origin. Could you maybe tell me a little bit about the training that you underwent? Or if you, some of the men didn't even want to undergo any training. This was later on, as a recruit.
Well, as far as the training is concerned, the first morning when I was, after I joined the Grenadiers, we were taken over for drill. Drilled for about an hour and a half, and I was sent for by Lieutenant Blackford to report over to transport. I went over and reported to transport, and I belonged to it right through. I got very little training there, although I did have training with the field artillery as far as drill was concerned. I had previous experience with as a peacetime soldier with the militia in North Battleford. I knew a little bit about it, not too much. And then I drove most of the time. Started out on the truck, and then the next thing I knew, I was a CO's driver. And I drove for Colonel Kay right up until he returned from Jamaica. And Colonel Sutcliffe took over on the... When we were on the boat on the way over, I was informed that I would have to combine my duties as a driver and a batman. Said I had enough trouble looking after my own equipment without looking after somebody else's. So then I was attached to the mortar platoon as a carrier driver. The only thing is I couldn't find any carriers to drive. All I did was carry bombs, mortar bombs up and down bloody hills of Hong Kong.
I go back. You went to Jamaica, and I gather that most of the Grenadiers were changed from a machine gun regiment into infantry at that time.
Yeah, that's correct.
I wonder if you can maybe remember how that sort of affected the men. I know a lot of the men would see bringing pencil machine guns, and they were very proud of it. I think they could take a machine gun apart with it.
Well, I think at that time, and I would venture to guess right now, that there was never a finer machine gun battalion ever left Canada than the Winnipeg Grenadiers and the Vickers machine gun. There wasn't any better anywhere. There were men in there, certain sergeants, and other ranks as well that could strip the machine gun down, put it back together, blindfolded quicker than a normal person could, with eyes wide open. So we became an infantry regiment when we went down to Jamaica, and garrison regiment down there. We went back over to Hong Kong. When we got over there, we wound up with damn little equipment. After hostilities broke out there, I never did run across one of our victors, but they tell me that one of our sergeants, a Ukrainian chap, I forget his name now, when we handed him the Vickers, he started to cry. That was his weapon. And myself, I had a funny experience there. I was CO's driver at Fort Osborne at the time. I'd been notified that I had to go and qualify with the rifle. Now, because of my duties at the time, I didn't get away, and when I did get over to the armies, I was told the instructor had fired my targets for me. So I said, fine, how'd I do? He said, you didn't do too bad, you scored 72. If I was denied, if just for the hell of it, I fire a set of targets. Well, I've always been a pretty good marksman. I fired in the 90s. Well, he fired in the 72 because he didn't want to make me live up to too high a rating. But I never did officially fire my own target.
Well, when you came back to Winnipeg from Jamaica, did you have any idea where you were going?
Did you think you were going to Europe or did you know you were going to Europe? Did you have any information, any leads you to believe that you were going anywhere? Or other than Europe? Yes. But as a CO's driver, I was under top secret oath to disclose nothing that I might learn by reason of being a CO's driver.
Did you know much about Hong Kong? I couldn't care one way or another.
I'd been down in Jamaica so damn long, and I was supposed to be a soldier. I was thinking of my daughter when it was all over, coming back. What did you do in the war, Daddy? Having to tell her I sat down in Jamaica there driving a general commanding the British West Indies, that was the total extent, and I was kind of anxious to get in and do my part, whatever it might be. So actually, when we were going to go into a theater of action, we were told it would be a theater of action that we were going into, although at that time it wasn't. How they knew, I didn't know, but I was rather reluctant in a way to go because I never had much time with a wife and my daughter when I first came back. My leave was cut short. I had to report back and then over there. But then, actually the feeling I had was if there was a job to be done, and let's get the damn thing done and get back on. Back on an even basis again and go to work.
Do you remember much of the trip from Winnipeg over to Hong Kong? The train ride or the boat ride or anything that happened?
Well, yes, there was a. When I first got on board ship there was a movement afoot to get off it. Because the quarters we were assigned to were below the water level, and big holiday cruise ship, there was plenty of room up top, but they didn't want us ruining the furnishings. Certain ones made it. And I, with a couple of others, were hollering at the rest to get into the columns of twos and march off. The front ones were stopped, the others keep on going. This was the way we were going to get off. I was locked up in the cabin. And the gangplank was pulled up, and it pulled out into the water so we couldn't get off. Next morning we went to draw rations for breakfast. Went down, of all bloody things, to feed a Canadian soldier. They had this, what do you call it? No. Cow's gut.
Yeah.
Tripe, yeah. That was all we needed. We were sleeping in hammocks above our eating tables. All we needed is try dishing out this tripe and take a look at it. Most of us were sick. Then the mutton started. Then the mutton went overboard and we got the beef that we had been put in. They fed us sausage there one day. We couldn't cut them. We had to untie the knot at the end and squeeze the stuffing out in order to eat it. No way you were going to cut that skin. I think that's where the tough plastics first came from, was the skin of those sausage.
I'm wondering if you can remember when you arrived, I know it's a long time ago, when you arrived in Hong Kong, you were getting off the boat and first seeing the Chinese people and marching up the camp at the time. Do you remember how you felt at the time, or how the other people felt?
Well, my feeling was to get rid of that damn load somewhere and get settled down and get leave so that I could go downtown and see what was going on down there. It was a new world to me. We'd studied it in school, but I'd found out that things that you learn in school don't necessarily hold true. There's an awful lot that you don't learn, and there's an awful lot that you've been told that probably, if you've never visited the Orient, you still can't picture it in your mind. You know that this happened because there's quite a few of the fellows have told you this. But until you see it, you don't actually realize or believe what it was like. Oh, the band was playing, we were marching along there. Hong Kong was more or less semi-tropical conditions, getting away from winters in Canada for a change. Oh, I'd had enough of that down in Jamaica. Everybody wishing you a Merry Christmas and the sweat rolling down. That's one time I drank like a trooper and I couldn't get drunk. It's Christmas Day, no way could I get drunk. Well, we marched up, we went into barracks, Sham Shui Po. And the first thing we were after was a mail call to see if there was any mail that preceded us over there. We zigzagged all the way over, so we figured maybe it had gotten there before we did. We wanted to find out what was going on at home. And after that, it was leave to go and see the sights and see what happened. There were a lot of sights, too, to see.
It must have been a very strange city at that time, sight from Europe and China. It would be very different from Jamaica. It would be very different from China.
No, it was different. They're all different. All the countries have their different customs, their different foods. Language was foreign to us there to a much greater degree than any place we'd ever been. English was spoken in Jamaica. There were certain things we were told there. We had to go through indoctrination by British officers and so forth. I think the thing that shook us up a little bit there was one of the officers, English officers, in his sort of orientation speech to us, told us that we were would be acting as a delaying action sort of troops. There would be no reinforcements if anything happened. We'd stand to the last man. Nobody likes to be told these sort of things. You got downtown, a few drinks, you forgot it.
Were you expecting war before this with the Japanese? Did you have any preconceived ideas about what the Japanese soldiers?
As far as I was concerned, I wasn't expecting war with the Japanese at all. I couldn't see where a little nation like that would dare try to go against the overwhelming forces of the British and Canadians, Aussies, and so forth. I didn't realize just how strong and fanatical type of people they were. I don't think any of us did, actually. First found out we were at war with Japan, and Jesus, it's going to be a pushover. It was a pushover. The only trouble is that we're the ones that got pushed over.
Did you do any training at any time in the weeks before
the war? Oh, I did a little bit on the boat. Personally, I didn't. I didn't get too much training. There wasn't that much time. We were more or less getting settled in. Did a parade square drill, fixed line firing, sighting in your rifle, getting caught with it dirty and having to clean it, that sort of thing. But actual military training, I guess I received very, very little myself. Some of the others in the regiments that were attached right to the fighting companies in the regiments, they received more than I did.
Now, were you still in the transport company?
I was still headquarters company, and transport division, yes.
Did you have any equipment at that time?
No. Matter of fact, we wound up there, I think it was with 9 mortars and no base plates for any of the mortars. Base plates were left back at some silly major standing on top and waving goodbye to us. All our equipment, all our armaments.
Can you remember how a war broke out, or when you first knew that war was declared?
Well, Archie Clements and I were supposed to go to a tavern owner's home for dinner this evening. We had passes and we went downtown. We were a little early before we went over to his, to where we were to meet, his tavern. I think it was the Hong Kong Hotel or someplace. We went for a couple of drinks. We were all in there, and an English officer, lieutenant, I think he was, came in. Told us to report back to camp. I asked him what the hell for. We had passes. He told us that it was imperative that we report back, all passes were canceled. We looked at each other and decided he's an officer in the Army, so we better obey, and we went back. And got back there, it was hustle and get your stuff together and get on trucks, and we were transported from there across the island. No, the Japanese had attacked.
Oh, they had attacked, but you were down.
They hadn't attacked Hong Kong at that time. Oh, apparently they had attacked Pearl Harbor and the outer limits of the Crown Colony of Hong Kong.
But you weren't aware of it at that time when you were in town.
Right. No, I was over on the island, and I think it was Archie again. We were on sentry duty in this graveyard on the side of a hill there when the first wave of planes came over, and I looked at him and I said, geez, what chance have they got? Our planes coming over, and it wasn't ours at all. They had the fried egg on there. They were dropping bombs. I found out later that one of ours got about 20 feet off the ground before it was shot down. Excuse me. Hello, Marner. Oh, I can hardly hear you, Charlie. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Now, this is just one thing here where I can't sit down and devote X number of hours to any one thing. I'm just going to slip that window open a little bit here so I don't strangle myself. A little warm in here. But I don't know where I was now. Well, originally, first couple of days, I was scared out of my bloody wits, naturally, because these planes were coming over and bombing. There was nothing to shoot at except one chance I got there. This plane came in very low and was heading right for me. And my old Lee Enfield, I had a dead bead on the pilot, just waiting for him to come a little closer, and suddenly a black object dropped from the belly of the thing. And I forgot about shooting. I was hugging the ground. But we were on a cemetery that was built on the hillside. It's more or less in steps all the way down. So I knew if it hit below me, it wasn't too bad. I got showered with debris, but that was about all. Pretty near a direct hit, or else just above you, maybe bury you with a bomb to do any damage. I knew that. I wasn't sure whether the bloody bomb knew it or not, though. But there's no, after the first two or three days, you just didn't give a damn. How do you mean operated as a regiment?
How long the orders were sort of flowing up from headquarters to the various units, some people have said that it was only about 3 days, they thought, and then they were told, well, you're more or less on your own.
Well, actually, the orders weren't coming to me directly, but I would say there wasn't much communication with headquarters after the first week anyway. We managed to get back together again as a unit under Queen Hughes. I never served with a finer officer in my life. I don't expect I ever could have done. He was all man. He understood us. When he first took over in transport there, we all had our doubts because he was a new officer that came to the regiment. He wasn't down in Jamaica with us. But he showed himself a man not only in the battle, but later on as while we were together in the same camp and as prisoners of war, he thinking of the men, and some of them weren't. Some of them were thinking of themselves only. I've always had a great deal of admiration for him, and we've had a few personal talks that are more or less confidential between us. I haven't kept too much in touch with him or any of the others since I've been back. I've been too busy carving out a life for myself. I left during Depression years, got married during the Depression, told my wife that I'd give her everything she wanted or ever did want. Never figured I would do it, but getting pretty close to it now anyway. It's a little bit shorter retirement, but we've got what we want. More or less, even though they don't own it. Credit union owns part of it. Thanks, Willie.
Excuse me for interrupting.
That's okay.
Can I ask about some of the things that maybe you did during the battle when you were sent to duty and you were driving?
I was on sentry duty, and then I was driving. Then we were stationed up on a hill, I forget the name of it now, slit trenches there for a while. I was shooting at shadows. I don't know why. I think I shot a couple of shadows. I don't know what the hell they were. I never did find out. The beginning, on sentry duty and driving and whatnot, as I say, you were too damn scared to worry about anything. But after that, through lack of sleep and so forth, it just didn't seem to matter. It was just a matter of, well, you live from day to day or moment to moment. Well, the water supply was cut off because the reservoirs had been bombed out. As a matter of fact, this was the excuse they used for surrendering because of the multitudes that were on the island and the lack of water and so forth. And some of the natural streams coming down the mountain, they looked pretty good. You took a drink out of them, but when you went around the corner, there was a bloated dead horse or something laying in the middle of it. No, I don't think I went without the necessities as far as food and water was concerned during the battle. It was after that that we started to really find out what it was all about.
Do you remember when the surrender came and how you found out? Were you wounded at all?
No, not actually. I wasn't hit by shrapnel or shell fire. My pride was wounded more than anything because I found out how bloody scared I was, and I was scared I was going to show it to somebody else.
And you weren't the only one.
No.
I think everyone was.
One of the things that surprised me were the number of atheists that we had in the battalion until war broke out. And once the firing started, they were all good Christians. It's surprising how flat you can get against the ground when the shrapnel's flying around, too. There's numerous incidents that I could bring to mind, but actually they're of no interest to anybody but myself.
to surrender. Do you remember how you surrendered to me? How you were notified of it?
Major Trist came back and told us that the war was over, and I remember at that time making a comment, well, they sure as hell didn't last very long, and he said they did, we didn't. And it was us that had surrendered, and we had orders to proceed to Mount Gough, I believe it was.
Remember how you felt at that time, about the surrender?
There was no feeling. I was so fatigued mentally and physically that there just wasn't any feeling at that time. But it took quite a while for it to really dawn on me, and when it did, there was just a wonder as to what the hell is going to happen.
Did you have any idea what the Japanese would do to you?
None whatsoever. We had, everybody, I guess, had their own pet little fear of what was going to happen because we'd heard stories and so forth. But actually, at that time, there were very few could tell the difference between a Jap and a Chinaman at that time. And sometimes, right now, it's very difficult. But they had the same thing in mind, I guess, as we had. Kill or be killed. And I found that most of them weren't too different from what we were. They were human beings. They didn't know why they were in there. They were going to save the world for peaceful purposes, and so were we. Actually, you're shooting at somebody you didn't know who the hell it was. You could have turned around and turned out to be quite a nice fellow. You'd have met him socially, but this is what war is all about, I guess. Somebody decides to wage war for some reason and they start beating the drums and waving the flags. Like a bunch of asses, we've all got to get into it. Be big heroes. You wind up in the middle of it by wishing to God somebody else was trying to be the hero and you were safe at home in bed. We were marched down to a university. We stayed there, I believe, for a couple of days while the Japanese had their triumphal march through the streets. Then we were taken down and across the mainland. We were marched miles through the city, back and forth to Shamsheripo camp again, and you kept walking or marching. We were paraded, actually, through the streets by the Japanese to show the Chinese people there that we weren't so hot. I guess we didn't look so hot right about then, neither. Then our internment started then, and they started feeding us rice. The beginning of the sweepings off the warehouse floors. You had to pick the glass with the back of butts and whatnot out of it. First you couldn't eat it because it was wormy. After a while, you got hungry enough to lick the worms off before you threw them away. Short time after that, it was their own bloody fault. If they were in there, you ate them anyway. Then we got split up. We were taken from there. I was taken with a bunch of others to North Point. We were put to work on Kaitak Airport, leveling it out so that it would be a larger strip for the planes to land on. A few things went on there.
Not much about the work, did it? they go on any day, did they get arrested long?
I think we worked 6 days a week. I think we had Sundays off. Wash our clothes, de-louse ourselves. Not too positive on it, but I'm pretty sure we had one day of rest. But the work varied there. There were different crews. When I first went over there, I was on hands and knees cutting grass with a little sickle. Then we went on to knocking hills down there, loading it in ore carts, pushing it out along and dumping it, sort of a leveling process. We worked at that for quite a while, and I developed plantar warts to a very serious degree where I couldn't get rid of my waste, and I was transferred to Bowen Road Hospital for an operation. I had two goes at it to eliminate it. First was by burning with a diathermine machine, and the second was cut them all off, which is something I wouldn't advise anybody to do. I stayed at Bowen Road Hospital there for quite a while. Very little medicine. No, there are quite a few of us interned there. I couldn't estimate the number. But I was handy with a straight razor. I used to go around the wards and shave all of the bed patients. And then in the afternoon, I had a shop down on one of the floors there where they'd come. A couple of blind fellows, I remember, come in there. No way were they going to allow me to shave them. They were going to learn themselves with a straight razor. A buddy mess the first few times, but surprising. They come in later on, you'd give them the soap, brush, and the straight razor, and they'd go over and turn on the water, and they'd shave themselves. Certain other individuals with a little attack of diarrhea or something, they were too sick to look after themselves, but men that really suffered the loss of a limb or their sight, or, you know, the ones that were really suffering were the ones that complained the least. Some guy with a little bit of an ache, well, he was complaining the most. I guess this is human nature.
You mentioned that you were involved with the escape of Kaczynski and Payne. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, we had planned, five of us, to get out of the confines of North Point Camp, get across the mainland, and travel by night and hide by day, and try and make it to Chongqing, 600 miles away. We realized there were a number of difficulties because of not being able to speak the language, not being sufficiently sure of ourselves when it comes to the identification of a Jap or a Chinaman. The realization that some of the Chinese were fifth columnists and so forth. And we were gathering what supplies we could for the journey. And I came down with dysentery and was moved into the hospital. The night I came out of the hospital, Johnny Payne spoke to me, and it was an ideal night. It was stormy and everything else. It was the ideal night to go, but he said they'd put it off until I was well enough to go, and I said, no, this was what we had been waiting for. This was the season we'd been waiting for, the type of weather and so forth, and go. I wish they had put it off because they were all caught. They were all executed. I remember, Billy Moore was one. Tiny, what was his last name? And different lookouts posted to make sure that the guards didn't catch us. We put the ladder up alongside the hospital, and the boys went up and over it, and we took the ladder down. I went to set the ladder over alongside the hut where it had been before, and this guard got by me. Oh, set that off. I'm just monitoring anyway. So the next day, I think it was, there was a bit of confusion as to the count. And I was sent to Bone Road Hospital for this operation that around noon that day. I understand from some of the boys that came to the hospital later that they stood at attention all night. They were trying to find out who else was implicated in this escape. Nobody said anything about it, so it sort of passed off. And after I went back from the hospital, we went back to North Point. Or did I? I go to North Point and then Shamsheet go straight over. I think I went back to North Point and then over to Shamsheet. Then we were given a medical and we were all packed on the... one of the Maru ships.
Remember how you were picked at that time?
Most physically fit, actually, were the ones that were chosen to go to Japan to work. I fell in that lot, and I wound up at Kawasaki at 3D.
Were you looking forward to going to Japan?
No, not particularly. But, in a sense, I guess I was kind of looking forward to any change, anything that would break the monotony. In my mind, I couldn't project the Japanese holding out for any longer than 3 months at any given time. If you'd asked me, I'd have said, well, within 3 months. But that 3 months stretched out into 3 years and 9 months before it was finally over.
You went to Japan, there were 30 Canadians in the
city? Yes. I think there was around 500 of us all together on the ship that went there at that time. Tatutsu Maru, that was it. Then we went to 3D, and I think some of the others went to different spots on that draft. We were working in the shipyards there, building freighters and so forth. You ship from one job to another, wherever you were. I was working in stores there at one time. I was given some canvas to cover a chair. Told them how much canvas I needed and everything else. They gave it to me and I recovered this chair for them, and I took the rest of the canvas back to camp and made a kid bag out of it. I got caught. Some bright young Jap student there noticed that there wasn't that much canvas in the chair, and I told him it was doubled. He wanted me to take it to pieces to show him it was doubled, so I figured, what the hell's the use? I may as well tell him I've got it all back at the camp. So I got a beating for that and kicked out of the stores, and I wound up cleaning up in the bottom of the boats there, the old nuts, bolts, pieces of metal, whatnot, that fell down in the cleanup gang.
Is the food, is the treatment any better between the boys and the French boys?
No, I wouldn't say so. There were different things that we got there that we didn't get back in Shamshiripo, but by the same token, there are other things we got back there that we didn't get in Japan. One thing in Japan, everything you got had to be boiled. You couldn't eat it raw, even cucumbers. We existed for months on cucumber soup. There'd be about 5 bushel of cucumber for 500 men, and this was boiled in water with no salt, seasoning, or anything else, and that was your soup. Then your rice was boiled in water, no salt, seasoning, or anything else, and your rations were laid down, and this is what you got.
Can I ask how you were feeling at this time? You've been in
No, I don't think it was quite that long when we were in Shamshiripo. Before we went to Japan, actually time didn't have too much of a meaning to me at that time. It was just exist till the next day. When I first went to 3D, I was on the heavy gang there forging keel plates. They did all this by hand. Well, it was a big shipbuilding yard, and we'd get the sheets, steel sheets. Well, then they had a 4-foot square forge in the floor. And the sheet could be lifted by electric pulleys and transported over onto the floor, which was steel with holes in it, and a sort of a V-typed holes in it, and a sort of a V-typed holder would be put on the sheet steel and shoved in the hole and pounded down with sledgehammers to hold it. And the Hancho or the gang would go along with a dolly on a long stick, and he'd move it around on the metal while you walked on there and hit it with your hammer and walked off. There was a relay, 4 or 5 men around. I never could wear the wooden shoes, so they gave us running shoes. I've seen the men with the wooden shoes walk on there and hit it and have to scuff the fire out, because you're walking on the burning metal all the time. I worked there for quite a while, and then I came down with an attack of malaria. And even at that, I was left in camp the first day. From then on until I recuperated, I was taken to work every day because they had to take so many men to work. So they used to pull me in the cart to work, stay in the mess hall all day and pull me home again, because that was another body at work.
Was there any leadership in the camp?
Each bay or section had their own leaders, and
this would be a hut?
Yeah, a long hut with bays in it. There's 50 men to each bay, I guess, roughly. And then there's our senior CO would be in charge at that time. It was a doctor. It was the senior CO in our camp. Dickens was his name, I forget. Well, that's where we started developing boils, and you name it, we had it. We managed to get a hold of castor beans there.
Castor beans?
Yep. We roasted those, and if they were roasted long enough, they had fine peanuts. But sometimes you got a little too hungry, so you didn't roast them long enough, and you ate them. Not the awfulest case of diarrhea I ever had in my life, I'll tell you. We were given nothing as far as personal sanitation needs were concerned. There was a bathhouse there. I think on three occasions when I was in 3D, they heated the water and we were able to have a bath in the water. Otherwise, you just took it out of the taps. With the diarrhea, I, along with a lot of others going out there, have had to wash ourselves off just to the overcovering roof that no walls or anything in the wintertime and cold water taps, which wasn't very pleasant.
Did you ever receive any letters from home in Redford?
Yes, I received two letters from home when we were at 3D, I believe it was. And they were mailed 2 years apart. I got them the same day. Another time there was a bunch of parcels came in, and we were told that these were parcels of the deceased. And we were supposed to sort them out and as near as possible so that each person would get a fair share of them. I noticed one parcel there that had been stuff had been taken out of it. It was broken. All the parcels had been tampered with. My name on it. And I tried to tell the camp commandant, but I was quickly persuaded that it wasn't my parcel. I did manage, though, to get some of the things out of it by trade. Those that I could trace down, the boys were more than willing to trade. We did get, I myself received 2 2/5 parcels, Red Cross parcels, in all the time I was there, and I understand there was enough Red Cross parcels sent over for every prisoner of war to have one a week. And I did notice when we were working in the shipyards, we were working on freighters, there were some Koreans working on submarines and so forth. I noticed them supplying them with Canadian Red Cross blankets, submarines. So obviously a lot of it was diverted to their own use.
Did you ever get any information from the outside to know what was happening during the war? What the Japanese were doing in Vietnam?
Not definite information, no. We didn't. When we first heard the word radar, we figured this was a new bomb site, that they could drop a bomb into a barrel from 40,000 feet. We didn't know what it was. We had no idea. We didn't get any information until just before the war was over. The way things were going, there was an indication then that something was up, and this was when we started to get any really valid information. But that was in at Sumitogawa when I was there. That was in the freight yards. We were working in the freight yards on unloading coal, and unloading boxcars, this sort of thing, whatever you happen to be on.
Was that a good job? Were you able to keep things out of the boxcars?
Yeah, we sure were. I used to go to work in size 12 boots. No socks on. Fill them with beans or rice or whatever I could. You can walk on that as long as the boot's full, but if there's one grain in there, it'll cripple you. Come in one day, the back of my boot split open, and I was sowing rice all down the road. The guys behind me were kicking dirt to cover it up so I wouldn't get caught. One time I got into some vitamin. I thought they were vitamins. I didn't know. I had this bunch of pills, and I brought them back to the doctor. I think I got nailed bringing something back one time. beat hell out of me. They had me standing in attention in front of the guard room. Every time I go by, they'd take a couple of swipes at me. Finally, laid me low with one of those practice swords, bamboo practice swords they got by hitting me across the Adam's apple. When I come to, I was in my bunk. I've got the sword at home. It's up in the attic at home. I don't know why I brought the damn thing back. I took it off the Camp Covenant. There, a group of students came along just before it was over, after we'd had a pretty damn good example of saturation bombing. And they were asking us questions. I was in Romicu at the time, sick. I had a bloody big boil on a big toe there, a hole you could stick your finger in. And they used to leave, I think it was 8 in the morning or 16 in the morning, 8 in the morning and 8 in the afternoon, that was it. My instructions from the sergeant of this group there was to tell the boys not to aggravate them in any way. Be very careful how they answered the question, what would the rest of the world think if Japan was to surrender? Because they believe in this loss of face bit. So I got talking to him, and the only thing I could get out of him as far as the war being close to being over was soon. Well, soon to a Japanese could be the next century, you never know. And one day the boys went out to work, and there had been a speech by Hirohito the day before, and one of our boys had understood Japanese. We got him into the shower room with his ear against the wall. But I don't think he got the full import of what was being said. But we did hear that there'd been an awful bomb dropped on Hiroshima, and Photo Joe used to go over every noon. We could tell by the trail he left which way he went, whether we were going to get it or not. But this day they all went out into the... There was something different in the air. They all went out to work. Oh, it was around noon, I guess. I heard them hollering for roll call. I got up the top bunk. You could look out the window, and I could see that they were holding roll call and getting ready to come in. Well, this was very unusual. I got down. I went to Maccabee, and I told him the war was over. He said, how do you know? I said, just know it. The boys are coming in. They're bringing them all in. The war's all over. Japan has surrendered. So he asked me how sure I was of it. I said, I'm sure enough to go in and tell the camp commandant that we wanted proper food and everything else, that the war was over or else. And he said, you know what'll happen if you're wrong? I said, I got a damn good idea. You still want to go? I said, yep. So we went in. That's when I got this bamboo sword that they use for practicing with. I took it then, demanded that the interpreter come in and make the announcement that the war was over. He did, and then Big Mac McRae and I, we went on foraging. We got out. No, there was no city there, hell. It was all bombed flat where we were. There was the odd chimney sticking up. The odd building somewhere, a three-story building, but it was gutted, nothing inside it. Coins and whatnot we found in the ruins from the heat. I think it was May 24th. Somewhere around there was one of the first bombings. Laying in bed, it was pitch black. You couldn't see a thing. Within a minute, you could have read a newspaper from incendiaries and everything. And about 500 B-29s came over.
Was the camp bombed at all?
No, the the location of the camp was, there was a high road went along one side, a canal along the other, and along the third side was this coal yards where the trains came in on trestles, and you unloaded them to either side. Well, these, they stuck out like fingers out in the canal, and they'd come in with the barges, and we'd unload the boxcars onto the sides, and then cart it from there and load the boats with the coal. So we were kind of protected there, even concussion and everything would kind of go over the top. That's why I had to get up the second flight there, like to look out the windows to see what was going on, because we were down in this depression. They came over one day there. That was after when they were starting to drop stuff for us. I had on a G-string, a pair of slippers, that was all. And we were getting the hell out of camp because these barrels were dropping 45-gallon drums loaded with stuff with a parachute. They'd tear loose from the chute and come down. I was running to beat hell to get underneath these concrete trestles. And I saw a big Mac ahead of me there. He let out a holler at me, jump, Slim, and I jumped, and just as I did, one of these bloody barrels of cocoa landed behind me. I got up, I was covered in cocoa, sticking to me, so. And we went out foraging there, we come back with a... I did, Mac was back there. I came back with a big barrel of beer. And a truck and brought it into camp. Boys were drinking beer, and I want to know where Big Mac is. Oh, hell, he's out behind the kitchen with Ed Curry and a bunch. So I went out there. I figured, boy, I'm going to tell him I got this beer. We're going to have a slug of beer. I got out there. Oh, Christ. You're just too late. We had some real good alcohol here, and we've been having a party with it, mixing it with pineapple juice. Oh, God, as I come back to a barrel of beer. I don't know whether I want that or not, but I'm sure we could go some of that pineapple juice. So they poured a big slug in one of the tins for me, and I took about 3 gulps of it, and it was straight alcohol that they dropped for sterilizing the instruments. Gee, so I looped. Big Mac and I'd go up and catch some poor little Jap coming along. Beat hell out of them, and then we'd run back into camp, and the soldiers had to stand there and keep them off. Yeah. The camp commandant, he got a hold of our senior officer and asked him to keep Mac and I in there. So we were raising the hell. I was taken from that to the Philippines. We were one of the first taken off the island, one of the last to get home.
Were you taken off by the Americans?
Yeah.
Did you fly with
the Americans? No, we went on the USS Bowditch, I think it was. Hospital ship. No, how the devil did we go to that? Yeah, we did too. And then we were supposed to fly from there, but then some of the GIs were squawking about us taking up airspace, and they wanted to get home too, so we come home in a victory boat.
Did the Americans treat you well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they treated us like kings. Got everything you wanted. In the Philippines there, we weren't supposed to. We were supposed to be confined to barracks. A bunch of us wanted to go downtown. We didn't know where the hell the city was. Manila itself, we were away out of the city, but we were going to go out on the road and thumb our way. Got to the gate, big MP stopped us and wanted to know what regiment we were with. told them the Winnipeg Grenadiers. He's, what the hell is that? He's one of the finest Canadian regiments you ever heard of. Oh, he says, you're LPWs, Liberated Prisoners of War. I says, yeah. He says, I'm sorry, I can't allow you out. You can find quarters. I said, yeah, we just want to go downtown. Well, he says, not getting out of here as long as I see you. Besides, it's a long way. Do any of you drive? I said, yeah, I drive. There's a car park over there, a jeep's in it. I went over and I got in one of the jeeps, the four of us climbed in. As we drove out the gate, he kept turning his back to us, but he had his hand behind his back waving to us. We went downtown, went into one bar. We'd been warned to drink gin, because apparently they couldn't poison it without something showing. When the Japs left there, they must have poisoned some of the liquor. I got pretty stoned there, and I was going to Biffy. I tried to get across the dance floor. Girl was doing a dance there, and she come up and started wiggling her belly at me, and I made a grab for her. She started to run there, following her with a spotlight, and I was chasing her. Everybody was bellowing, go get her, Canada. I don't know where she disappeared to, but I was in the camp. And I come out, and a couple big MPs at our table. Came back, I said, what's the matter, fellas? You guys are telling me, man, these MPs were called here because of a disturbance. Some guy was trying to attack one of the employees. Well, Toa explained what the situation was. Is your liberated prisoner of war? I said, yeah. I said, go ahead, have fun, but for God's sake, don't start any trouble. And they left us. How we got back to camp, I don't know. I didn't drive any jeep back, I know that. As far as I know, the jeep's still sitting somewhere down on the street from Manila. Then we came back by boat to Everett, Washington, or Seattle, Washington. No. We wound up there. We came back to San Francisco. We were going by Alcatraz. There's a nice, great big sign there in rocks painted white, whitewashed. Well done. Welcome home to Alcatraz. Yeah, they gave us $200 on board the aircraft carrier there for spending money, and we never did pay that back. American uniforms and everything else.
American money? Mm-hmm. American
uniforms? Yep. All kit and caboodle. Then we got back to... went over to Fort Lauderdale, had supper, and came back, got on the train to come north. And the train stopped, made a wild dash out there and bought beer. I put $10 down on the counter, and I wanted a half a dozen bottles of beer. He gave me a half a dozen, counted out my change. I grabbed it and shoved it in my pocket and run back on the train. I got back there, I had my $10 plus the change. We got into Seattle, one place we went. Two of us, Sergeant, from the Royal Rifles. We went out on the town together. We went and got the works, haircut, manicure, shave, shoe shine, the whole bit. We had the patches on our shoulder then. They wouldn't take any money. It was his turn to pay, too. So then we went to eat. We went down into a restaurant there. Had a sirloin steak that was the size of a steak platter. My turn to pay, I went to pay. No, we had Canada, that was what we had on. So the cashier asked us if we were from Canada. I said, yes. You're liberated prisoners of war. And I said, yes, we're from Hong Kong. We're just on the way back. She pushed the buzzer and the manager come over, asked us how we liked our meal, and we said, fine. One of the best we'd enjoyed in years. Told us it was compliments of the house, and that was it. Started out with $200. I got to Victoria, I had $212 and some odd cents. And we'd been drinking and eating all the way. By the ordinary Joes, yeah, not by the government, no. Hell no. When we got back, some of the guys there, when they were issuing us with the Canadian battle dress, they were telling us where to put our American stuff in this big barrel here. Fellows that were with me, I was like, hell, we do, that's ours. That was given to us by the American government. We don't give it back. Well, you don't get Canadian if you don't. Well, keep your Canadian then. So then they decided to give us an issue of Canadian stuff, and we kept the American suntans and combat boots and everything there, beautiful boots. Some bugger stole those off me before I left, though. Now, here, there, well, it was a couple of days I was there, because my sister, commissioned officer, she was in the city, and one of his family was very ill or passed away or something, so we were shoved through in a hurry to come right home, along with Captain Reed, was it? Anglican minister, anyway. So when we were given our travel vouchers and everything else, the first thing we found out, we were in day coach, and he was... I don't recall. I don't think we were. Oh, we must have been given some because we spent money. And of course, we still had this 200 American. I don't recall that. I do know that. We got on the train there. Captain come and found Speck and I and wanted to know what we were doing there. And I said, this is where we were put. So he called the conductor. Told him that no way were we staying there. We were going back into the sleepers. That's for officers only, the conductor told him. He said, don't give a damn what it's for. These boys are going back with me. Or something's going to happen, so... Well, about 20 minutes later, the conductor came back and had us move into the sleepers. We didn't want them, the officers, but we went back. And then when we went for breakfast, he was ordering ham and eggs, toast and coffee, and we looked at the price, we looked at our voucher, and we were 2 bits short. So we were ordering toast and jam and coffee. He said, what's the matter with the ham and eggs? And nothing. But as we're only allowed a buck and a quarter, and that's a buck and a half. Let's see that voucher book. He got hold of it, and he raised hell again, so all our vouchers were changed. So that we were entitled to the same. When we got back here, it was so... You went... through your demob sort of situation, which took a couple of weeks in hospital for a while there while they studied us. Everybody else's name, Ukrainian Sergeant Major, you had no trouble calling everybody else's name, but when he got to mine, it was always 86782. Couldn't pronounce my name. Good Irish name. You can't pronounce it neither. Smarter. Well, that, God, he'd come out with these long Ukrainian names of the skis and the witches on the end of it, and then he'd call my number. Then you'd go one place for something, and when you come back from that, you'd fall in a different line. Finally, we got out of it. I guess I've told you just about everything. I receive a pension too, but I had to fight for it. In some respects, I think they've treated us rather well. In others, I think we've been treated rather shoddy. According to promises that were made by politicians and so forth, as published in the newspaper, what they were going to do first, they certainly didn't live up to that. Our suffrage pay that was allowed to us, I understand, though I could be wrong, but I understand that the other troops, the Americans and the other prisoners of war, received the full pay, that is double what we got. We still haven't been awarded anything of that sort. And one of the ministers, I won't mention any names at the time there, made the statement that he didn't think we should be paid this suffrage pay because it would encourage further desertions in the face of the enemy to get more money. I think that bastard should have been in the front lines and found out what it was like, or should have undergone that treatment. But I still feel that the government in time will see where they have omitted the reimbursement of this money. Not that I need it so much. Some of them may, I don't. I'm not going to turn it down if it's given to me. I want to retire. I'm retiring early because I just can't hack it anymore. I feel that I've done well to go as long as I have. Insurance companies and everybody else assures us that our experience has shortened our life expectancy by about 20 years. Well, hell, I want time with the old lady just to relax and retire on. If I wait till I'm 65, I don't think I'll make it. My 5 years could be the last five I've got, so I got my boy who'll be starting in university next year, and I think I can swing it. Mrs. and I can retire. That's what we're looking forward to anyway. So if the government wakes up and kicks through with that other little bit, it'll help me get some of the things I may need for my retirement.
Can I ask how you feel about the Japanese?
As a whole?
Yeah.
No different than I do of anybody else. I don't blame the Japanese people or our individuals. How do you feel about the Irish now that you're reading the things that are going on over there? No, but there are certain individuals over there that committed these atrocities that you do. Well, this is the way I feel about the Japanese. There are certain individuals that I've got it in for because the treatment that they gave me, but why should I have it in for their brother or their sister or somebody that I don't even know? This is the same thing as a war, okay, so why should you go and fight a bloody war? Those that want it, those that decide we're going to have it and whatnot, put them in the middle and shoot it out and be done with it. You climb into battle there, you're taking pot shots at somebody you never saw before. You don't know whether he's any good or whether he isn't. The only reason you're doing it is if you don't hit him, he's liable to hit you. It's senseless. What are you fighting over? What There isn't anything you can fight over today that can't be settled by other means and a better settlement reached. Because of a few Frenchmen that put bombs in the mailbox. I don't hate every Frenchman. Damn near, but not every one. I better not hate every one, the boss of my department's French. No, there's... As nationalities go, I can't say that I dislike any of them. It's individuals, yes. I have my likes and dislikes.
I don't have any more questions. We talked for an hour and a half, about 4.5, 5 years. You don't have any more questions.
We didn't talk, I talked.
But I had a few questions.
But you try and listen to it back from this thing here, and it'll turn you sick.